finished its third winning week on a positive note. Welcome, everyone, to GoldSeek.com Radio. Your host, Chris Walczak, back with you for another big show. Now that investors are losing faith in the precious metals sector, the wise contrarian in all of us should be taking note. Silver investor David Morgan says that the lows are likely in place. Silver could see much higher prices from these levels going forward. Then Harry S. Dent Jr. and I discuss his latest book, as well as his outlook for U.S. equities. He's far from sanguine on the stock market, calling for the Dow to drop to as low as 5,000. Well, I don't let this bearishness pass without considerable questioning. I think it makes for a lively and informative discussion. And Robert Ian returns to the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the Market Weather Report. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals exchanges this week. The yellow metal finished its third winning week on dollar sluggishness and weaker than expected U.S. payroll numbers. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added about $11, finishing at $1,248 an ounce, a gain of about 1%. Silver ended near the break-even point around $2,017 an ounce. Platinum outperformed yet again, adding $24, up about 1.7%, finishing the week near $1,437, while palladium gained about $16, ending at $743 an ounce. To taper or not to taper, that's the question. Although in the initial jobless claims dropped by 15,000, a five-week low, investors turned to the precious metals safe haven on news from the Labor Department of fewer domestic jobs created last month than expected. Payrolls inched higher by 74,000 on the heels of a 241,000 advance revision for November. It was the smallest rise since the beginning of 2011 and well below the consensus forecast gain of 193,000 jobs. The unemployment rate did fall, though, to 6.7%, a substantial drop from 7%. Primarily the result of folks giving up, though, and dropping out of the workforce. The news convinced investors that the Fed might be more reticent in reducing its monthly bond purchases from $85 billion a month to $75 billion. At the last FOMC meeting, officials omitted a detailed description of the proposed tapering plans, preferring instead to keep Mr. Market guessing for the time being. Elsewhere, the rousing Tiger Nation has apparently trebled its gold stockpile in only a few years, even surpassing Italy and France to become the third largest holder of gold. China's government coffers have swollen by around 1,000 tons to 2,710 metric tons since April 2009, eclipsing Italy's 2,400 tons and France's 2,400 tons, according to the World Gold Council. One insider said that China's officials' ultimate goal is to accumulate at least as much as the U.S., which still holds the world's biggest stockpile of 8,100 tons, assuming that the gold is not swapped and leased, perhaps several times over. Quite a large assumption, too, according to GATA.org's figures. Well, the golden siphon continues to swirl as real money flows from Western central banks directly into Eastern. The Asian nation's consumption of jewelry, bars, and coins rose 30%, about 1,000 metric tons in the 12 months ended in September 30th, while usage in India, the second biggest buyer, gained 24%, also about 1,000 tons, according to the London-based World Gold Council. Nevertheless, demand issues continue thanks to India's gold and silver import restrictions. Inbound shipments of the precious metals were off by over 250% over last year, according to their commerce secretary. Imports declined 30%, about $27.4 billion worth in the 9 months through December. The government increased the tax on purchases three times last year to 10%. Curbs are expected for the next 3 months, and gold imports will likely be cut by 45 tons this year, according to the World Gold Council. Bottom line on precious metals. Weaker than expected payroll numbers certainly capped the dollar rally, which closed in a perilous technical position, helping the metals, I think, to help post another solid rally. So for the rest of this report, all of next week's stock picks, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, after briefly hitting an all-time record high, cloudy skies returned to the New York Stock Exchange. The Dow Jones Industrials finished the week off 32 points, ending at 16,437 by Friday's close. The S&P 500 was up 11 points, ending at 1842, about 0.5%, while the Nasdaq actually added 18, nearly 0.5 percentage point. For the week ending just above 41.74. The unemployment rate fell to 6.7%, lowest level since October 2008, near the credit crisis lows. Yet the decline appeared to occur partly due to more people dropping out of the labor force. Some 347,000 Americans were no longer looking for work in December. According to one media report, when the non-farm payrolls report is worse than expected, well, about 9 out of 10 sectors average declines in the S&P 500. The more resilient sectors are utilities, materials, and consumer goods, while the hardest hit tend to be technology and financials. Nonetheless, most analysts do not expect any serious Fed tapering until 2014, which should help offset the minor blip in the jobs report, most likely due to the recent cold snap. Investors are absorbing comments from the new Federal Reserve chairwoman, Janet Yellen, who noted in a Time magazine interview she expects stronger economic growth this year. The news was viewed as equities positive. Bottom line on Wall Street. According to our 7-component sentiment index, greed is present, but it's not really significant enough to indicate excessive bullishness in the equity sector. So for the rest of this report and next week's forecast, remember to log into your newsletter account. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Harry S. Dent Jr. and David Morgan. So we want you to stay with us here at GoldSeek. Precious metals investors endured a difficult market last year, to say the least. According to one analyst, though, over the last 13 years, no single government currency has outperformed gold and silver. Returning to the broadcast with his outlook for the new year, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show the silver investor, David Morgan, publisher of the Morgan Report at silver-investor.com. David, how are you doing today?
Chris, I'm doing quite well.
You've actually said for years that this economic Titanic continues to slowly take on water. Eventually, a rogue wave could send this vessel to Davy Jones' locker. Could you outline how silver could maybe be the life preserver for many of our listeners today?
Certainly. A couple things. One is, it's a fact that every time that there has been a fiat money system, or a lot of people even say that a gold system is fiat, but a system that is an unbacked, unsound monetary system, it's failed. So we have a 100% track record, and you know that fact, and you ask yourself a simple question: what would prevent the U.S. dollar from going the same way as all these other times it's been tried? And you have a very good answer, then I'm willing to hear it. So it's on the road to destruction, even if you use the government's own numbers, the Federal Reserve's own numbers. The 1913 dollar, when the Federal Reserve took over the monetary system, what you'll have is a dollar that's worth roughly 3 cents. So it's lost 97% of its value in approximately 100 years. You know, so that's fact number one. Fact number two is that there has never been any time when it has been a non-gold-backed currency and you had a currency crisis that they haven't on the method of inflation. So the deflationists say, well, you know, you're having deflation, and certainly can argue both sides. I can make both arguments. I'm pretty skilled at making the deflation argument or the inflation argument. But I want to work with facts. And the facts are that any time you've had a non-backed currency and it's been destroyed, it's been through an inflationary process, not a deflationary process. And that makes sense to me, because if you look at gold being, you know, used as money for thousands of years on and off, you know, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. And certainly there's been other methods of making transfers. I understand that. But overall, the public has voted at large that gold is very sound money, silver as well, most of the time. If you go back and look at that, then the dollar is basically doomed. And the way it's going to be doomed is that the path that it's been on for so long is going to continue. And the big question is, when does it accelerate? When do people give up? When the dollar's worth, you know, 2 cents of the 1913 dollar, 1 cent, 1/2 cent, and how does it get there? But the main thing is that gold has survived for thousands of years at some value, and paper money never has. So it's really that succinct. Paper money always fails. And if it always fails, will the dollar fail? Well, I think you can use some logic and determine it probably will. The big question, of course, is when, how, you know, when, really. And how is also an important question. In every other case where we're not backed by anything, it's been through an inflationary process.
So let's also address, if we could, one of the more interesting aspects of this current dilemma we find ourselves in with the silver market. You know, according to your work and others, the price of silver is currently unsustainable due in part to the fact that it's under the cost of production. I'd like for you, if you would please, to tell people why this fact could be so significant.
Well, it's not well under the price of production. I mean, the price of production, of course, varies mine to mine. And in a, you know, polymetallic mine, like a base metal miner, like an RTZ or BHP, those type of huge conglomerates, they basically use silver as a credit for the base metal mining. So if you check their books, they're going to tell you they mine silver at a negative cost. Of course, that's just an accounting error or an accounting trick. But if you come to a primary silver miner, generally speaking, and we looked at many, many of them, you're around between like $21 to $23 per ounce. So right now at under $20, we're under the cost of production of most mines. So the market is very efficient over time of determining what takes place. So one thing that could take place is the price of silver rises. Another thing that could take place is mines go out of business. They can't make a profit, and they close their doors. So the market will take care of this. I am biased to the idea that that this will obviously curtail production rates, and you'll see the price rise. But that doesn't necessarily make it right. You could see just a curtailment in the market. But there's so many reasons to think why people would buy silver, not just for industrial purposes, but for protection and savings and that type of thing, that there's probably going to be a pretty good demand on the silver market continuing, especially both sides, really, investment, because you can buy it near the cost of production. So someone that's of that mindset would probably take that attitude. And secondly, the industrial side. I mean, anyone that really knows how to run a company might want to warehouse some silver if they can get it under the cost of production. So there's reasons on both sides why you would want to basically get into the market at these levels.
Market forecasts are tricky because prices are so dynamic. But you have said in recent comments that you were looking for as high as 30 to 40 on silver and even 1,700 on gold by year end. Do you feel that perhaps Wall Street insiders dumping their shares onto the public could be the impetus sending the metals higher as those funds flow into a safer haven?
I think so. There's a lot going on the stock side that, you know, needs to be addressed. One is that the juniors, for the most part, are just a train wreck, and many of them will fail still. The smarter companies, the mid-tiers, are looking for assets they can buy very cheap, so there'll be some mergers and acquisitions. The powers that be, or though I should say more specifically, the more knowledgeable investors and mining concerns, meaning like CEOs and COOs and people that really understand the mining business, are taking positions on both sides. In other words, getting out of companies that are not viable and getting into companies that have assets. And they're making good strategic plans from this point forward to buy undervalued companies. And there's many of them that are, you know, much safer, meaning like we do in the Morgan Report, where we have the mid-tier and the top-tier companies, whereas we do speculations, but we stress to use money you afford to lose and to take at least 5 out of the 10 picks that we have and use dollar cost, and use equal dollar amounts. So we just had one blow up on us. It was probably one of the best, you know, story stocks you'll hear. It was one of the richest gold mines on the planet. And, you know, with the adage is, Chris, in the business, the rocks don't change. You know, the asset's there. But the management, and I don't want to blame the management per se, certainly they had something to do with it. If you've got a very rich, high-grade resource, and it was just misplanned. I mean, I've been in this business a long time, and I've seen it happen before. That's why when people always ask me, you know, what's your favorite junior, I give them a really quizzical look, like there is no such thing, because some of these best story situations can blow up, and this one did, and it's unfortunate. We had an investment in it, and several of our members did as well. And these things are they're heartbreakers because, you know, we do our best to find the best. I'm not a big believer in just a shotgun approach of just anything with gold in its name. You know, buy it because it says gold. I mean, a lot of this stuff is just dirt. You really want the highest grade, best assets you can find. And when you find one of those and it doesn't work out, it takes a little bit off you.
I've also gone on record noting that silver could be a better long-term investment than even gold. I wonder if you could tell folks why, as silver approaches its more historic gold-to-silver ratio, as we start to see that reestablish itself, just how silver could be an interesting component for every gold investor to have in their portfolio?
Well, a couple reasons. One is there's a lot more poor people on the planet than there are rich people. But this is true, and I think most people that are objective would agree with me. And so what this means is the poor man's gold is much more affordable. So as gold starts to accelerate up, and it will, I don't know if it's going to be, you know, this year or next year or whatever, but I really think it's within the next few years, and I think this year will be a good year for gold, but not a great year. Regardless, what will happen is at some point, and I don't know the number, it varies individual to individual, but when gold's at 2,000 or 2,500 or 3,000 or whatever, people will look and say, my, look at the gold price. Because it's so expensive, I think I'll buy silver. Silver's only, and pick a number, under 60 or under 70 or whatever. And a lot of people really don't look at like a P.E. ratio or what the value is. This is why the penny stock world is so attractive. People think that, oh, I can buy 1 million shares. It's only 0.01 cent per share. You know, like that is important. You know, cheap stocks are cheap for a reason. It's because they're not worth very much. I mean, that's the reason. This kind of attitude will spill over into silver, meaning that a lot of people say, I missed the boat on gold or it's too cost too much for me to afford it, but silver doesn't. So when the mad rush hits, and I think this time it's going into the history books, I think this time when people wake up, you're going to see people rushing into these markets like never before. They're going to say, oh, gold's too much, or, you know, I've got $3,000 to invest, or I don't want to buy one gold coin, I'll buy silver with it. And since there's really a tighter market in the silver market than there is in the gold market, you could see silver's ratio come down substantially. I mean, people make light of the ratio, and you can do with it whatever you will. The fact is that the ratio tells you which one's performing the best. And when the bull market in silver started, the ratio was 80 to 1, and now it's 60 to 1. So what that means is it used to take 80 ounces of silver to buy an ounce of gold, now it only takes 60. And that says a fact. And the fact is silver's outperformed gold from the start of the bull market. Now, you could take a different starting point, which some of my, oh, I won't say adversaries, but some of the silver bears like to, and say, well, if you started here and go to here, then silver hasn't done as well as gold. And that's well and good, and I understand that. But I'm trying to look at the big picture, and I'm trying to start an equal starting point. And that's when, you know, when did the silver bull market begin? September 2003, I called that. And from that point to now, you know, the 80 to 1 to 60 to 1. And it's been all over the map, by the way. Certainly it's been as high as 90 intraday, and it's been as low as 35 to 1. So certainly the ratio has moved quite a bit. I think the overall trend is what's important, which is that silver so far, and I think will continue to outperform gold. So I think I hit the question.
I think it begs another question, just how quickly we watched the Bitcoin phenomenon take off. You know, we're talking around $4 or $5 per digital coin, running up well in excess of $1,000. It's an interesting parallel between the silver market, as you were talking about those 2003 lows in the neighborhood of, I want to say, $3.50 to $4 per ounce, just how quickly you could see something far more tangible take off like a rocket ship.
But one thing that people haven't really talked about, at least from the interviews I listen to, and I certainly don't hit them all, but I hit many because it's, you know, it's my work. I mean, I try to catch almost everything in the silver space, is what happens when this tipping point's reached, or people say, oh my goodness, my pension really is going to be worthless, so the banks are closing, or they are going to bail in my money, or whatever it is, whatever the event is. What do you think the coin dealers are going to do? You think if they really believe that the currency is going to be destroyed, that they're going to actually sell metal? And I know the end is nigh. I'm closing my shop.
You know, that's precisely what occurred in Zimbabwe recently, when the shop owners recognized, you know, the price of this bag of flour, the price of these eggs doubling every hour. I think I might just hold on to it. And then the farmers wised up and the distributors wised up since we're losing money by selling right now.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. So there could be, I don't know if there would be, but there could be a point where you either have it or you don't. And there could be a point where no amount of fiat's going to get it for you. In other words, you know, it's like, well, I'll pay you, you know, the current price of silver is $100 an ounce. I'll pay you $120. I'll give you a $20 premium. I don't want your money. I don't want it. I'd rather hold this. I'm more confident in holding this coin than I am holding any fiat for any amount of time. And as you just illustrated, it's happened before, and it could happen again. And this dollar situation, as I explained at the beginning of our interview, is a situation that you really know what the outcome is. What you don't know is exactly how and exactly when. But would you like to be in a situation where you had your $30 silver when it's at 20 right now, and then for an example, 6 months from now, there's all the dealers close shop and say, no, we're not selling, we're keeping our inventory. I mean, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but certainly things like this can happen and have happened, and I would take that stance. If I was running a coin dealership and things got out of hand, I would just walk away. I'd say, you know, doors closed, just like these brokers do when the market goes south. They just don't pick up the phones. I mean, this could happen.
I find it alarmingly ironic. Detractors of gold and silver and the merits of owning precious metals have a tendency to take the flip side of that argument and use it against investors in gold and silver. For instance, they will argue folks could never return to gold and silver because there's just simply too much money out there to be covered by gold and silver. You recognize the algebra doesn't add up. It just means that eventually the true value, the true price tag has to go on each ounce of gold and silver.
Yeah, well said. I mean, I could, you know, a thought just popped in, so I'll voice it. You know me, I'm not bashful, but, you know, if you could take a magic wand and it's a truth meter, in other words, you wave the wand and all you get is the truth. The truth is that a piece of paper isn't money. That's the truth. A piece of paper is currency. And Mike Maloney, I think, is one of the best at explaining that in his video series. So if we took the magic wand and said, okay, everybody in the world gets to keep their money and they wave the magic wand, then all the paper would go away. And what would be left? And it would be gold and silver. Now, this is just a thought experiment, and it's almost preposterous to say, but the point I'm making is backing up what you just said, and that is that you can print to kingdom come. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at a $100 trillion bill from Zimbabwe. They were printed but never issued. The thing had collapsed before they were able to actually get them into the people's hands. Nonetheless, this is what it had gone to. I mean, talk about absurdity. You know, wouldn't you like to take one of these $100 trillion bills over to Janet Yellen and say, here, I'm paying you off?
I wanted to move on here to a story affecting the supply of the metals around the world and the emergence of China as a burgeoning superpower. You may have recently heard that they now are taking over the sobriquet of number one gold consumer as well as number one gold producer. Kind of an interesting double moniker there, if you will. You've gone on record recently noting that as China absorbs this global supply, that it could be the opening salvo, first shot fired, igniting a short covering squeeze.
Because China has taken a stance very positively in the gold market, this and there is a huge power struggle at the top. I wrote about this in the Morgan Report several months ago. There is what I call the Anglo-American Empire, which is basically your London/New York consortium of global elitist bankers that have run the system for a very long time. But they and their arrogance doesn't guarantee that they're going to come out on top because you have a counterforce with the BRICS, primarily Russia and China, saying, no. You know, when we're not buying into your system. And this struggle is taking place as we speak, and I think it'll continue. And where it usually comes down to, and it has in history, is the old adage, he who owns the gold makes the rules. Now, if the gold in Fort Knox, it doesn't exist, or maybe it does, but I doubt it, regardless of where it's sitting, it's ownership. Who has it? Well, China is being very deliberate on what they own because they're shipping it into their country and locking it up. This is where we're going. So we're going to see a point in time, I think, where you're not going to necessarily get the global currency that everybody's talked about for a long time or some circles. You may actually come out with a new reserve currency. Maybe it's a yuan. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily the case either. What I am saying is it's not a lead pipe cinch. It's not a fact of complete that we're going to see the American Anglo-American Empire come out on top on this thing. It may not. In fact, if you ask me to vote, my vote, and you can read it in the Morgan Report, is no. I think you're going to see the power shift to the east. Usually the power, from an Austrian perspective, from the Austrian economist perspective, is capital is a means of production. Whoever's producing the most is producing what? Wealth. What a concept. Who's producing the most wealth right now? China. Does China have problems? Yes. Why do they have problems? Well, many reasons, but one of the primary reasons China has so much trouble is because they caught the Keynesian disease. They bought into the Western banking system's way of doing business, using leverage. That's the problem. I mean, you know, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds were very bright in going over there and saying, we're running out of, you know, we're running out of pigeons for our Ponzi scheme. And the only way a Ponzi scheme works is to get more people at the bottom. Oh, wait a minute. There's 1.2 billion people in China that haven't caught on to this yet. That'll keep the game going for a while. Let's get them involved. Oh, yeah, and that's good for what? Another decade or so. And that's what's taking place. But the time is ending, as far as I'm concerned. And believe me, I've been saying this for a long time. Doesn't make me right, but it certainly is more than just a flippant opinion. It's a very studied, very carefully analyzed opinion. And my opinion, this thing is not going another 5 years. It's not.
You know, I'd like to shift the focus, if I could, to the silver market. You've studied the Hunt Brother fiasco. The powers that be capped the price around 50, and yet, once again, early 2011, right around 50 again. I'd like for you to discuss how that scared the powers that be and what it might imply this time around.
One of the best books is one called Silver Bulls by Paul Sarnoff. If you can find it, it's probably a very high-priced book on Amazon, I'm guessing, because there aren't many copies of it. That's probably the best play-by-play, day-by-day, hour-by-hour of what happened. The Hunts had both futures and physical metal. Rumor has it that they, the Hunt brothers, were going to sell off some of their oil holdings to meet their margin calls in the silver market. And that's when things closed down. They stopped trading. You could only have sell orders, and they had a little meeting. It was one of my passions in life to be able to speak with Bunker and interview him either privately or publicly, if he would allow it. And I actually met the one of the trust managers for the Hunts, and I've known him actually for years now. And, of course, made that request, and it was denied. Did they corner the market? I mean, you can argue either way. I'll stay neutral on that. The point is that their main purchases were far under the, you know, $30, $40, $50 level. Once this thing caught fire, they'd already made their acquisitions. The second point is, you know, why did it stop out at, you know, $48, $50 again? I think that had something to do with it, Chris. I mean, this is a nominal number, but most people don't even think about inflation. I mean, there's people out there, as hard as it is for me to believe, that think that, you know, $50 in 2011 is about the same as $50 in 1980. And of course, that's preposterous, but they didn't stop to think. It's like, oh, silver stopped at 50. Yeah, it stops at 50 again. And the powers that be know that. So that nominal value, that nominal number, has a great deal of meaning. They, the CME, the Commodities Mercantile Exchange raised the limits on margins substantially, like four times, maybe even five, as silver was moving up rapidly. And that, of course, helps cool off the market. They do that in other markets. It's not just silver, but certainly they had to do a lot more in silver than other markets. You know, normally one margin change is enough, and two is usually plenty sufficient, but they had to go beyond that. So there's a lot behind the silver market. I mean, look, I've been looking at money for most of my life. I've been studying, you know, money, metals, and mining, which is, you know, the subset of the Morgan Report, as my passion for a very long time. I'm always learning more. I don't know all there is to know about the silver market. I find new, you know, interesting facts about silver, you know, maybe on a every other week kind of a basis. But there's so much happening that I know one thing. Nothing moves like silver moves. If you look at all the commodities, I mean, you can go back and look at rapeseed, which is a very interesting name. It's now called canola oil. But the rapeseed market had a big move if you go back in history. I mean, I follow these markets fairly closely. And any commodity can accelerate and move, but nothing moves like silver. And there's a reason for that, and that is it's a tangible asset. Going back to the Bitcoin situation for a moment, the one thing about the gold and silver market in the physical realm, which is a very, 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 very tiny part of the market, because most of the market is a derivative of gold and silver, but not actual physical metal. But the physical reality of those two markets is so small, and it's one thing that stands above and beyond anything else that can come close, and that is that it's real and it stands outside the financial system. If there was a complete electronic failure, for an example, or a bank holiday or a brokerage closure or ATM problem in a certain part of the country or the world, gold and silver in your hand will work anywhere. Now, I'm not saying that everybody on the street's familiar with it enough to take it in barter or whatever, but it doesn't take long to show them what it is and convince them in many cases. And in other parts of the world, it is almost a daily occurrence. There's parts of the world that take, you know, gold much more seriously or much more as a normalcy than that is done in, say, North America. So, but the main point is back to this. These two assets stand outside the financial system and outside the monetary system as it exists, alone and above anything else. There's no other thing to think about it. There's nothing else that does what these two can do. And yet, how many people are even aware of that or even aware that, you know, why it's so important? Many people sort of have a sixth sense that something is wrong or even drastically wrong with the system. The old bongo care isn't working. You know, they're cutting back this and that. They keep printing money. Something's wrong. It doesn't feel right. I don't feel as wealthy. The dollar doesn't go as far as it used to. All these monikers about things not being that desirable and something wrong, but they can't really articulate it, nor come up with a solution, nor think through what would it be like if, and pick your scenario, ATM failure, CME event, bank holiday, brokerage holiday, the EBT cards stop working, a merchant closes his door. I mean, just there's all kinds of probabilities out there, and they're commonly referred to as black swans, and there's a lot of them. One of them might just land here, and we just don't know when.
Returning to your nominal silver price concept, we talk about $50, let's say, back in the 1980s peak, and then, of course, fast forward to 2011. I guess that's 30-odd years. If we use the inflation adjuster, you're talking in the neighborhood of 2.5-fold higher than the 1980s peak. So the real price of silver then, $125 to $140 per ounce. Fair value and intrinsic value, very difficult topics when it comes to almost anything from stocks, bonds, let alone commodities. Do you care to give us your estimate for an intrinsic value for silver in 2014 terms, please?
That's a tough one. Well, what I'm going to say is probably going to upset a lot of people to follow my work, but I'll, and this is an objective, non-silver bug perspective. So Harry Brown, who's one of my mentors, and you can look him up. It's Brown with an E, B-R-O-W-N-E. He was the Libertarian presidential candidate twice. Going back years and years ago, he did a report in his newsletter, again, years and years ago, and talked about the intrinsic value of silver, and it was $10 at the time. And $10 silver, when silver was sub 5, was, you know, in real terms, a gain. But if you looked at it as if silver had nothing other than what could you mine it for, and it was purely a commodity like copper or aluminum or tin or nickel, if it was that only, then what would it be worth? And the answer to that question, in my opinion only, would be probably around the $40 level in today's dollars, which are subject to change almost minutely. However, that's not the reality in my view. The reality is, what is the price of gold? So I'm going to come back to silver, but the price of gold is, what is gold used for? And the answer is, it's used for money. I mean, it coats the space helmets of the astronauts, and yes, it's used as a heat shield in some of the space shuttle areas. I used to work in aerospace. And yes, gold is used on an industrial level at a very, very minuscule level. So gold's real purpose is money. And it has the classic part of money, which is a store of value, that a gold coin today is going to buy you something. It bought you something 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and it's going to buy you something 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 1,000 years from now. It's going to have value. And people have determined that over centuries. So now silver has actually fulfilled the same role as gold. In fact, it's been used more places and more often as money than gold has. But you get the gold-centric people that think only gold is money. And the fact is, silver is the monetary metal of history. And that's not me saying it. That's Milton Friedman, and he's a Nobel laureate in economics. I'm not. But history shows that. But people forget history, or they don't learn it, or they don't understand it, or they don't believe it, or they choose to ignore it. I don't care. The fact is, silver has been used as money. So because of that fact, silver has an intrinsic value that would be higher on a monetary basis than on an industrial-only basis. And because of that, it's something that's inherently known to certain groups, not only the gold and silver bugs, maybe the 1% of us that exist in the North American region, but if you go into India, I mean, you're looking at probably half the population understands what gold and silver are all about. You go into some of the other Asian countries, it's a lot higher percentage as well. So it's something that's indeterminable as far as what is the real value, because it's whatever the market determines. What we do know from history is that in extremely lucrative times, an ounce of silver or a dollar's worth of silver, which is about three-quarters of an ounce, was a man's wage. But if you go back into the Roman Empire, a tenth of an ounce is a man's wage. So if you think in those terms and you think of, wow, what if I put 1,000 ounces of silver away? What would that represent in Roman times as far as days of work? It's substantial, very substantial. And there's not that much silver around. I mean, how many people would have to do that to basically take up the silver market? But these are type of arguments you never hear from Wall Street. You'll never hear in the mainstream press. You have to, you know, ferret out on shows like yours. And people will say, that sounds really good, but, you know, and Morgan sounds like, you know, fill in the blank, good, bad, indifferent. I don't really care. But I'm not going to buy it. You know, silver's at $40, and it's at 20 now. Why would I buy it now? Which proves my last point. People don't buy bottoms. We already called the bottom. The bottom is in, as far as I can tell. The bottom occurred 6 months ago. We've been building the base higher than the 1817 intraday level for over 6 months now, and I know it's coming up. Could it go below that level? Yeah, it could, but I really, really doubt it. Every day that goes by that we're above that level proves that the bottom is in.
Please tell folks more about the Morgan Report, what they'll find at silver-investor.com.
You bet. The bottom of the page, you can see our Twitter feed and our YouTube channel. Those are both for free. We also have a weekly free e-alert letter if you want to get on that, and you can get off it if you wish. And then, of course, there's three levels of service, the basic, the intermediate, and advanced, and those are all explained on the right-hand side of the webpage on a pull-down menu.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show economist Harry S. Dent Jr., head at H.S. Dent Economic Research, the forecasting think tank, and author of The Demographic Cliff, already number one bestseller in its class at Amazon.com. Welcome, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris.
Let's begin today with the demographic cliff, how to survive and prosper during the Great Deflation of 2014 through 2019. Now, before we delve into the topic of the demographic cliff, where your work shows that there is accelerating retirement of the baby boomers, threatening economic stability, I'd like to put that topic in abeyance for a moment and turn to your foundational demographic work of how this has worked in the past and adding significance to how it could be working for us today. I wonder if you could recapitulate how the baby boom generation was responsible for the roaring economic boom in the 1990s, and how that fundamental demographic trend is shifting and is much more precarious.
Yeah, you know, Chris, I mean, I was a consultant, the first at Bain & Company to large companies, and then to new ventures and smaller companies in the 1980s, I'm sorry. And you know, I was discovering that all these growing companies were appealing to young new baby boomers. So I got into demographic research, and I discovered by 1988 the greatest cycle I've ever discovered, and it was the spending wave that new generations enter the workforce around age 20, earn and spend more money, get married, have kids, buy houses, cars, all this stuff, borrow money. And that cycle peaks at age 46, and then it declines sharply after age 53. So I came up with this simple indicator. You just move the birth index forward for 46 years, the peak in spending in the average family. And that's what told me in the late 1980s and early 1990s that the U.S. was going to see its greatest boom and stock bubble in history in the 1990s. And at the same time, Japan was going to have a great fall. And in late 88, 89, we predicted both those things with this one simple indicator. And then the good part of it is I can go to any country in the world. And guess which country, after Japan was the first to collapse back in the early 1990s, which we predicted, guess which country has the worst demographics in the next several years? Germany. China kind of plateaus and slows, which is very unusual for an emerging country. All emerging countries have stellar demographics for decades and decades in some cases. China is starting to slow, and nobody gets this, but Germany has the fastest fall off in demographic spending trends as people age of any country other than Japan, and actually its drop in the next decade is steeper than Japan's was in the 1990s. So everybody's expecting Germany to hold up Europe, and I'm like, hey, they are thrifty. Hey, they didn't have a big bubble in real estate and everything else. They are hardworking. They do export a lot, but their demographics are horrible.
Before we move on, I do have a question for you, because I know there's going to be a lot of sharp listeners in this audience. How do you factor in the possibility that this indicator that you developed, this demographic indicator, which is quite impressive, do you at all worry that it could be coincidental? In other words, that, you know, maybe the Fed was also pumping an excessive amount of monetary stimulus over that 1990s period?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Chris, I've studied bubbles and cycles in everything back hundreds of years, any data, anything. And what you always see is there's fundamental trends. It used to be more commodity cycles and innovation that drove the economy on 29 to 30 year cycles. The Kondratieff wave used to be the dominant cycle. And then it became generation cycles as we developed the first middle class families in from the roaring 20s forward. So that changed thing, and it changed which cycles are important. But it doesn't matter what the cycle is. If there's a fundamental driving it up, then people will speculate again. The people will get complacent. You know, governments will try to fuel the boom, you know, and you create bubbles out of it. I think I understand the fundamentals better than anybody and how they've changed the last century. But any time you get a boom like in the early 1900s or in the 50s and 60s, or especially in this last boom with and governments pushing down interest rates. But you have to remember, we didn't have QE until after the last crash. It was just governments would lower interest rates and allow more speculation and easier lending every time we had a crash. But they didn't come in and inject trillions of dollars.
I mean, I guess you could argue that in the 90s, Japan did to a lesser extent, but not to this degree. Are we victims of our own affluence? And what I mean is, if you look at this amazing increase, the economic boom, and not just economic, but demographic shifts that occurred arguably just over a century ago as petroleum became so widely used in our economy. I mean, as you know, Michael Rupert is so fond of saying, each one calorie we consume requires 10 calories worth of petro energy. That's got to factor into demographics dramatically as we now come down the right side of Hubbard's peak. How do you suspect that this decline in petroleum output will impact the demographics and then impact the economies?
Well, you know, they all work together in a cycle of innovation and challenges and booms and everything. And you got to remember, before oil came around, you know, coal and wood were the dominant sources. They were way more polluting, more expensive. Oil was cheaper and cleaner when it came along. Now oil's gotten expensive and obviously not clean. All I see is that you have one cycle of innovation after the next. When something fails, when something gets too expensive, or like when we had inflation in the 1970s, we got personal computers and wireless phones and all this stuff that is, you know, helped to create lower inflation and new opportunities. So that's the way the free market system works. It booms, it goes to excesses, we see extreme inflation, and then when that goes down, we see extreme deflation. And, you know, I mean, we see innovation, creative destruction, boom, bust, inflation, deflation throughout history. It's like male and female. You can't live with them, can't live without them. You know, that's what makes the system work. You don't create energy in a battery without positive and negative poles. And politics doesn't work without Republicans and Democrats, whichever side you're on. So that's the way I see the world. Yes, we have limitations today, and I think there's going to be major breakthroughs in energy, alternative energies, in the next decade, and it's not likely to be solar. I got a little place in Puerto Rico in the middle of nowhere on an island on top of a hill. Solar's my solution there. But am I going to use solar? Here, it's not as cheap. It's not competitive, and neither is wind in most cases. So I think there's a bigger breakthrough, and you know what? I think, Chris, I'm predicting oil prices are going to go to $20 to $30 a barrel in the next decade and probably $30 to $45 in the next 2 to 3 years. I think oil prices dropping are going to change the game and force something radically more cheap and more clean than the present alternative energies. But, you know, that's just the type of stuff that happens.
You also note that inflation rises when large numbers of young folks enter the workforce. The opposite, deflation when large numbers of seniors downsize their homes, they cut back their spending. So with the baby boom retirement scenario approaching, that would lead, obviously, to massive deflation over the next 5 years. Tell us more, please.
Well, you know, first of all, I tell people, look, why are we debating all these issues, inflation, deflation, demographic? Japan's already gone through this. Japan peaked between late 89 and 96 on our demographic cycles. I was the only person in the entire world, I think, that predicted Japan was going to burst in the 90s, and they did, and they've done QE now since 1997, you know, for a decade and a half or more, and all they've got is a coma economy. You know, stimulus doesn't work when fundamental trends are pointing down in demographics and debt loads are too high, and Japan's just increasing their debt. So I look at, you know, let's look at Japan and learn from them. Their real estate bubble peaked right on the demographic top for spending in real estate in 1991 for Japan, way ahead of ours in 2000, you know, in 5 and 6. And it's gone down 60% and has never bounced very much and is still near its bottom. One of the things happening now, Chris, is real estate lasts forever. And that means that when people die, they're sellers of the real estate. Young people buy all the real estate between age 27 and 41. That's a demographic fact. So when you have more dyers or increasing dyers versus buyers, there's less and less need for new real estate and less upward price pressure. I don't think real estate's going to ever be the same again. So, you know, we just look at a lot of things, and demographics would tell you, like Japan has been struggling with deflation. They've been stimulating constantly, and they still have had a zero inflation rate in the last two decades. Now the U.S. and Europe are stimulating feverishly, and you would have thought this would have caused, I mean, any other period in time, especially 1970s with inflation, you would have thought we would have hyperinflation out of this. We have inflation fell in the last year. That's why gold dropped. I actually thought gold was going to go up to 2000 before it peaked, but gold dropped because despite escalating stimulus, we still have falling inflation. The stimulus is not going into consumer prices. It's going into financial asset bubbles, and that's what's going to kill the Fed. They keep stimulating the economy to keep the bubble going, and it creates bigger bubbles that burst again, and then the economy goes down despite their best efforts.
Speaking of bubbles, some folks are calling the stock market a bubble, and you say, well, stay clear for a year or two, expect as low as, 5,800 on the Dow. But, you know, there's going to be a lot of folks in the audience again who are going to say, look, 2013, we saw the S&P hit a 32% total return. How does improving corporate earnings expected throughout 2014, how does that factor into your analysis?
Okay, first of all, earnings have been decelerating over the last year or so, and they're going to decelerate even more. I mean, they've gone up dramatically. For the first, I mean, stocks were following earnings for most of this rebound, but a lot of that rebound, 40% of it by calculations, were just from stock buybacks, companies using super low interest rates from the Fed, short and long term, to buy back their own stock and reduce the float of their stock so the earnings per share goes up, and that's what drives the stock. Interest rates have been pushed down artificially by the Fed, and that has increased corporate profits. My estimate is that 60 to 70% of these earning gains have been totally artificial from government stimulus and pushing long and short-term interest rates down. And what the government's saying is, we don't trust the free market system. We think we know better. We're going to decide when the economy goes up and down. We're not going to let this debt bubble deleverage. There's nothing better after you have a debt bubble or a financial asset bubble to let it deleverage and deflate and make the cost of living and investing affordable again. So governments are, and I just think governments have worn out their welcome here. They've shot most of their bullets. We've gotten a 5-year increase in stocks, longer than I would have thought, but stocks are now extremely overvalued. They're hitting new highs. Every time we've seen a bubble hit new highs, guess what's happened next, Chris? They've crashed to new lows. That's been the trend since 1995. Bubble up, crash, bubble higher, crash lower, and now bubble higher, crash lower. That's my forecast, that the Dow's going to peak somewhere around 17,000 early this year, and then it's going to crash to 5 to 6,000 by 2015 or 16, and ultimately will bottom as low as 3 to 4,000 before our long-term cycles turn up again in demographics, geopolitical, commodities. I mean, we measure everything. I've studied comprehensively everything you can study in economics. My chore has been, how do I decide what cycles are important, and how do I not just identify a cycle because it repeats, but identify what drives it so I can project it?
But, you know, when you start throwing numbers out there, you're talking nearly Great Depression-style collapse there.
I've been saying this for 20 years. I said back in my first book in 1989, we'd have a Great Depression between 2008 and 2020-23, when the largest, imagine this, the largest generation in history, the baby boom, and around the world, it's not just the U.S., peaks in its spending and starts to save for retirement and then retire. Old people and dead people don't drive economies. I mean, it's just that simple. And we've never seen, and that's the point of this new book, The Demographic Cliff, it's not just that the baby boom generation is peaking in more and more countries around the world and turning down. It's the fact that almost every developed country has a smaller echo boom following it than the baby boom. We've never seen a smaller generation follow a larger generation, unless you go back to the Black Plague or something like that. I mean, this is something the world has not calculated in. Yeah, we know there's going to be more retirees per worker. That's the only thing that economics gets about this. They don't understand that it impacts real estate, it impacts stock prices, economic growth, population growth, workforce growth for decades to come. And we're lucky in the U.S. We've had a lot of immigration, and I'm going to Australia in February to speak. They're the luckiest country in the world. They got more immigration than anybody. They're one of the few countries I see that actually could have positive economic growth from demographics for decades to come. U.S. goes sideways, but most of Europe, East Europe, Russia, East Asia, including China, go down. They're going to lose pop. How can you grow your economy when your population and workforce are declining?
Certainly agree with you. I was reading the IMF's numbers report, that is, on Australia. They were forecasting huge numbers a year ago, and they were spot on for Australia. And, of course, Canada, they also like Canada. I don't know if you see strong immigration into Toronto, Montreal, and Quebec, and a few of their top cities there, as it ties in with your demographic thesis. The scenario you're outlining sounds so much like something we would hear from Gerald Celente, a good friend of the show, who tends to have a more negative outlook on our economy and political system. He would say, and so many of my other guests, that we see cracks in the foundation here, that we're not going to go back to the status quo as we always did following every recession from, let's say, 1930 all the way through, let's say, 2006 or so, that now we're entering a whole new world. Maybe you can kind of bring it together there and explain just what that world's going to look like going forward.
Yes, you know, I would agree with that, I mean, we have had, actually, to go back to the late 1700s, when I call Harry met Sally, democracy and free market capitalism joined together for the first time in history, we have had a bubble boom in stocks and economy and global growth ever since then. But even in that boom, I'm writing a report today for my company, we had two major resets. You know, the 1835 to 43 depression and then the 1930s depression, those were two major resets. Anytime you boom and bubble, people are going to overborrow, as I said earlier, and overspeculate, and you're going to go to extremes. But that's part of the process. It helps innovation that new technology companies like in the 90s could raise money easily and try a million things. So it's just part of the process. But those bubble booms are always followed by great resets. And deflation has to take the debt and leverage out of the economy. It has to take financial asset prices from extremes. Everything's overpriced. Condos in Manhattan, art, antique cars, stocks, commodities, everything's overpriced and needs to come back down to reality, especially housing for the next generation to be able to afford the American dream again. So we're, to me, this is not another recession like you just said, or just another slowdown. This is a major reset that happens once in a lifetime or once in a century in many cases. And I think it is going to be, I almost get a little conservative and don't say how bad I think it could be. I don't think it's quite as bad as Salente, but I do see civil unrest, and I see China the worst place to be in the next decade. I don't want to talk about China. It's so bad, such a bubble. But the U.S. is a difficult place. I'm going to Australia next month in February and giving a series of presentations. I am almost ready to move to Australia. Civil society, best demographics in the developed world, high immigration from Asia, educated people. But they've got overvalued real estate, and oh, do they sell a lot of stuff to China.
There must be alternatives then to stocks and some of these other investment classes that you deem overvalued. And, of course, that leads to the greenback, the U.S. dollar. What other alternatives come to mind? Where would you be shifting folks' investment portfolios?
Yeah, I mean, I have three things, and you can vary these with your risk profile. One is the safest people should just be in cash, just be in short-term CDs and T-bills and, like you say, just in cash, and let this next bubble work its way out in the next few years like the last two bubbles have, and then reinvest when it gets to levels that we deem are more affordable. And again, 5,000 to 6,000 Dow would get me investing again in a few years from now. The second level is the U.S. dollar, and it's not holding greenbacks. You got to invest in a bull dollar fund or UUP, an ETF that measures the U.S. dollar against other currencies. Yes, we're printing too much money, but Japan's printing more than we are, and Europe did before this and stuff. So it's a relative thing. The U.S. dollar was the safe haven in the last crash, especially in the second half of 2008. Everything went down. U.S. dollar went up. So the U.S. dollar index, however you invest, can offset that. And if you're more aggressive, I mean, the best investors have always understood this. Every bubble or stocks or anything, they go down faster than they go up. It takes most bubbles 5 to 6 years to build to extremes and then 1.5 to 3 years to crash. So stocks go down faster than they go up. So you can also short stocks to some degree of your portfolio. Again, depending on your risk profile. If you're 65 and don't want to take any risks, just sit in cash, eat a little bit out of your portfolio to survive the next years out of your cash, and then reinvest when stocks are 60-70% lower and real estate's 30-40% lower and on and on and on. And that's the way I look at it. There's three sectors But there aren't many sectors because, as we saw in 2008, Chris, when the bubble finally burst, almost everything went down. Even gold went down. I was surprised at that. Even gold and silver went down in the second half of 2008 because we had deflation instead of inflation. The world doesn't understand deflation because we haven't seen it since the early 1930s, and none of us were around back then.
Yeah, I would add that gold was really remarkably resilient during that. When I look back over the charts, I'm astounded at how it snapped back so quickly and never really even broke its trend. However, bonds, you know, particularly corporate bonds, they were just decimated in bond funds. You know, in retrospect, it looked as though it was the end of the economic world. But if I do recall, municipal debt held up remarkably well.
Well, you know, to me, I mean, and municipal debt has changed a lot. What I tell people, if you are going to invest in municipal debt, you want wastewater, water plants, and things that don't vary with the economy. Nobody stops flushing their toilets in a downturn. But even toll roads and things like that, people may reduce. But if you're investing, you want revenue bonds that are tied to a secure cash flow stream, like, again, water and wastewater are my two favorite things in the muni world, especially if interest rates go up and keep going up, which I think they will this year at first before they fall again with deflation. I would want to lock in high quality treasury bonds and things like that and these revenue bonds with municipalities. People have retired and entered the workforce at very steady rates for the last couple of decades, the baby boom. But, Chris, you're right, that's going to change. Older people are going to stay in the workforce longer, as already is happening in Japan, and younger people are going to have a harder time entering and live with their parents and all this sort of stuff. So that's part of it. Demographics is a broad cycle. Every 40 years, boom and bust. I have many other cycles, and I have a new boom-bust cycle that occurs about every 10 years, roughly. And that cycle is the biggest trigger for downturns and crashes, and that cycle points down from 2014 to 19. So I was premature and predicting a downturn because I didn't think governments would stimulate this much. But this new cycle tells me the real risk period is 2014 and 15 and even into late 2019. So, again, I'm a cycle guy. And every time I make a mistake, I discover a new cycle. That's my learning process.
And would you say then that it would be wise to use the cycles, these demographic trends, and then also obey the price trend, meaning that once we see that break in, let's say, the Dow or the S&P or the NASDAQ, we start to see the weekly trend really break down in price, use that as more of your timing indicator. Is that also reasonable?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have windows where we think this downturn will happen. So, yes, I'm looking for – I actually have two scenarios right now. One is that this little correction we're having here deepens into late January, and then we see one more run up because my technical indicators, which are even more short-term, don't suggest we're nearing a top or we're not quite there yet. But if the market does keep melting up as it has since most of 2013, then I think we could peak as early as late January. So, I mean, you know, the short-term and the long-term are opposites to me. Long-term trends like demographics and technology cycles and commodity cycles are so predictable. It's like, you know, unbelievable, and people just don't look at that and see it. But shorter-term cycles depend a lot on politics and all types of events, and they're much harder to predict. I can tell you this bubble's going to burst, but I can only say here's a range of time I could see that could peak. It's much more difficult to call short-term trends than long-term.
Very good. Well, listen, we want everybody to pick up a copy of your latest book, so please tell folks where you'd recommend that they find a copy of The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 through 2019, please.
You know, I always recommend, I went to get David Stockman's book, which is one of the greatest books I've read in a while. I couldn't even find it at Barnes & Noble, and it's selling well. You know, you don't know what bookstore is going to sell. I just go to Amazon. They get it to you in a couple days. It's usually free shipping. Amazon's great. And we also have a free newsletter at harrydent.com. I mean, it's a daily newsletter. It keeps people people up with our thinking and what we think about current events and any, you know, new long-term research. I mean, it's just, you can't go wrong with that as well. But this book, I tell you, Chris, I've written many books. The Great Boom Ahead was my greatest book, but this is my next greatest book after all the books I've written.
Very insightful and must-read information. I want everybody to direct your web browsers to Harry's webpage that he's outlined there and pick up a copy of this book. We'll look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. We have crossed the threshold into 2014. Analysts, economists, futurists, newsletter writers, and commentators have provided a multitude of forecasts for what this year will deliver socially, politically, and economically. 2014 is going to be a difficult year on all of these fronts. Why? Because the banking crisis never ended. The housing crisis never ended. The misinformation surrounding unemployment reporting, with the artificially skewed emphasis on U3 unemployment figures, will reach a point where people begin to realize they have been misled, as more people lose their jobs and inflation and interest rates continue to rise. This will lead to a heightened sense of mistrust, and the pressures on what remains of the middle class will grow exponentially until the next episode of the financial crisis explodes onto the scene. Rewind 5 short years ago to the heart of the 2008-2009 financial collapse. Iceland, a country of some 300,000 people, was devastated with failed banks. Political, social, financial, and judicial crises ensued. Rather than bailing out those banks, Iceland treated them like private companies that went bankrupt and let them fail. A decision that was not popular with other Western European countries who wanted to punish Iceland for defying the will of the banking institutions that caused the collapse in the first place. Gordon Brown of the UK did just that when he invoked anti-terrorist legislation and put Iceland on the terrorist watch list. How does one of the most peaceful countries in the world end up on a terrorist watch list for simply standing up to the banks that crippled it in the first place? We've already seen how the breakdown of the financial system can threaten democracy in one of the most peaceful countries in the world. What's going to happen to the next country, who may not be as peaceful, when it stands up for itself during the next chapter of the global financial crisis? The attempts to break the will of the Icelandic people should be a constant reminder of what will happen to the next country or state that tries to exert its independence in the face of the next crisis. Only next time, those attempts will be more orchestrated and coercive with the mechanisms that have been installed since 2008. This is not old news. It is very relevant information. Iceland ripped the Band-Aid off and dealt with the financial crisis in real time. Almost no other countries have done so. Those challenges lie ahead for all countries that are continuing on the route of trying to print their way to prosperity. Iceland chose to focus on its recovery and is now seeing its energy, tourism, IT, manufacturing, and fishing sectors doing better in recent years than they did just prior to the banking crisis. The global banking system appears to advocate capitalism. But in reality, it has given true capitalism a black eye by privatizing its profits and socializing its losses. That recipe is not capitalism. True capitalism has never really been achieved. At best, there have been varying degrees of a mixed economy, which has been labeled as capitalism, the negative results of which have been used to discredit the very nature of capitalism. Because true capitalism is something that banks the world over are deathly afraid of. Chris, on February 21st and 2nd, I'll be speaking at the 2nd Annual Liberty Mastermind Symposium in Las Vegas with 15 speakers, 3 panel discussions on one amazing day. Details are on my website, and until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.